This course is a study of the nature of humanity and sin. We will look at the nature of humanity from a biblical perspective, examining the pre-fall and post-fall state of man. We will see how these issues were dealt with from a historical perspective, spending much time on the debate between St. Augustine and Pelagius. Attempt will be made to understand the implications of man being created in the image of God. Debates about the origin and nature of sin will be examined by asking questions such as, what is sin? Where did it begin? Why did God allow it? And are there different types of sin? Now, I don't guarantee we're going to answer all of these questions or any of them necessarily to your satisfaction, because as we study these, we leave here with somewhat of confusion. But we'll look at how the history of the church has dealt with these and the options that are available. And like with everything else, your answer is going to have to fit into your systematic theology. Whatever you choose here, whatever you're persuaded of, and me and Rome really are see eye to eye on much of this stuff. But if you decided to see eye to eye with us, then it's going to affect all of your other doctrines. It's going to affect how you view your salvation. It's going to affect how you view God. So all of these things will play their part, as we will see. Look at the course objectives. The student will come to know God more fully and truly, and we believe that you will come to know God more because you come to know yourself more. And that'll be a big case that we make, is part of the way that we do come to know God, or a major part of the way, is by looking at ourselves, people who are created in the image of God, who reflect God. And so knowing yourself, as one theologian stated, knowing yourself is the first point to knowing God. And then he said also, knowing God is the first point to knowing yourself. And so they're interrelated. This is just theoretical knowledge. We're not just getting in here to state what is man just to, so we can know what man is, but we'll see that it applies to our lives in so many different ways. Very, very much applies to our lives. One of you state that if you held to a certain view that would elevate the spiritual or the spirit side of man above the body, you're going to have a theology and practice that represents that view. You're going to state that my main concern is not to deal with my body, not to worry about so much the here and now of my body, but just to worry about the development of my spirit. And you draw a large dichotomy between the two, and it's difficult because, as we'll see, the dichotomy cannot be drawn so clearly. There's separateness in ways, but there's also connectedness in other ways. But we'll see. The student will have a greater understanding of what it means that God was created in the image of God. What does it mean when we say we're in the image of God? Are we still in the image of God? Were we in the image of God whenever Adam was created, but whenever Adam fell, we are no longer in the image of God? Or is there certain aspects of the image of God that we no longer have? How are we supposed to view that understanding we are in the image of God? And again, that will dictate so much of your ministry, so much of your theology, so much of your relationships with other people. Because if you see other people who are unbelievers as being in the image of God and you have a definition for that, there's a lot of dignity that goes to that person even in their unbelieving state. But if you see it as if we've lost the image of God and we don't have the image of God until we pass to the afterlife, then you see people as non-dignified, and you begin to treat all people, Christian or non, with less dignity, including yourself. And so we need to be able to understand what it means that we're in the image of God, because God gives us two explicit warnings about how to treat people who are created in the image of God.
Issues of cloning all have to do with what does it mean to be in the image of God, and then what are the medical, what are the medical results, what is the give and take from taking such a position. So we're going to lay the groundwork for a lot of very important things that are even going on in our society today. Some of the complex medical issues with the advanced technology on what is personhood will all be addressed from as we establish what does the Bible teach about what is personhood. Obviously, the basis for the abortion debate, and when does life begin? That has an issue right here with what does it mean to be human? What is basic humanity? So it's really a key course in establishing those things. If I was to teach a class on evangelism, this is where I would start, with humanity and sin. if I was to teach a class on something like bioethics, or any kind of ethical or moral class, I would start right here with humanity and sin. If I was going to teach a class on missions and the call for missions, I'd start right here with humanity and sin. Because all those things are built on the framework here.
And counseling, too, for that
counseling
matter.
Counseling as well. Would start right here.
The people who are in counseling have a very definite anthropology, hopefully. They have a very definite anthropology, and that anthropology guides them on the way they counsel people.
So in keeping with the structure of the theology program, this is the foundation of which lots of other things are built. We may not go into all the other things, but you will encounter them. We want to be here of the essential important things, and that's why a class like this is so important.
Number four, the student will learn the effect that the fall had on the mind of man, as well as his moral, social, and volitional abilities. And I think that if we just promoted this class as a class that talks about free will and how that relates to the sovereignty of God, we'd have this whole place filled. We could fill up the auditorium. We just had a Dan Wallace, who is part of the theology program, give a pastor's conference just to the pastors here at the church. And after he gave it on postmodernism and how to witness to postmoderns, but afterwards we sent out a survey that asked what all the pastors would like to hear next, and a lot of them were talking about the relatedness of free will to sovereignty, you know. And so I'll send out an email and tell them all to come on in here and hear us discuss about it. But it's a huge issue. What is free will? We talk about free will a lot. Have we ever defined free will? Have we ever really struggled with it, both historically and practically? We're going to struggle with that. Is there such a thing as free will? Is free will limited in any sense? Where does God, the sovereignty of God, come in and alter? And if he does alter, doesn't that affect our free will? And if he does affect our free will, is that fair to the next person who doesn't have free will? Is Adam's sin imputed to us to such a degree, or his sin nature imputed to us to such a degree, that we, as St. Augustine would state, we no longer have liberty in our free will? We have free will, but we can only choose evil. Well, look at those things. Those are huge issues throughout church history. And you remember in Intro to Theology, I put that chart that showed the different denominations in Protestantism. And remember how it broke away at one point, and there was only two major separations. Well, the separation comes over this issue of free will. And so how you define free will really define where you place yourself within the church as far as theological placement with which one of the two camps. It is the issue behind that started with Luther and the Reformation and his debates with Erasmus and also Calvin and on to Jonathan Edwards, and on we go, the discussions of free will. And so we'll tackle that. Number five, the student will learn that while man is not what he is supposed to do, he is supposed to be, he retains great dignity reflecting the glory of God. And then what you will do, the student will gain an appreciation of human dignity. Number two, the student will explain and defend the concept of original sin. That's going to be one of your case studies. I think you have your case studies on page 9 and 10. And the first one has to do with human constitution, and the second one has to do with original sin. You will discuss with some people, and we'll discuss this in class, whether it was fair to have Adam's sin imputed to us. I mean, we might state, you know, I never had a chance. If we take this Augustine's position and state that our will is inclined to evil from birth, from the very beginning, you say, well, I just never had a chance. You know, how can you hold me responsible for something that I was already inclined to do? I didn't ask to be inclined to do something. I didn't ask. Put the scale even. Make it even for me and give me my own shot. It's a good question, isn't it? Really is. It's something that spiritually you're not supposed to ask, right? Because that's something we're just supposed to state, well, we don't go there because it's too hard. But let's ask that question. Let's see where people throughout church history, where they have stood on that. and we'll have a greater understanding of the different views that are out there and where they came from. Because it is a hard issue, very hard issue, to state that the sin of another was counted to our account. The sin of another, not only are we held guilty for, but we now inherit his corrupt nature to where we are corrupt from the beginning. Number three, the student will critically evaluate the modern notion that people are all good at heart, as well as will critically evaluate the modern evangelical notion that all people are evil. Okay? Because we can have imbalance one way or the other, to where we again do not dignify anybody any longer by any means, because we understand the corruption that is set in. But I don't think that's what the Bible does. I think that there's a balance that's placed there. While we are evil, we are still dignified. The student will memorize the key terms that are necessary to understand the issues of humanity and sin, and you can look at those key terms on page 8, and there's not as many as there have been in the past. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7. So once again, I'd encourage you not to get started on that late. There's also, again, the opportunity to take this class for honors. Many of you got an email before class that said this was going to be an honors textbook that you could read, Willing to Believe by R.C. Sproul. This deals with the issue of free will. It's going to deal with it from one perspective. He's making an argument. He's not trying to be very balanced in this necessarily. He goes through history and shows the history of the argument, and then is very persuasive towards one view. But I think it's a good book, and I agree with most of what Sproul states in here, if not all of it. I don't remember anything that I necessarily disagreed with. So a good book. Also, another book that is, there's an asterisk by, I believe. Let me make sure. Yeah. Designed for Dignity by Richard Pratt. This is a very good book that he's very balanced in the way he approaches humanity. He talks about the dignity that all people do have, but at the same time, as this chapter says, sinking into ruin. That dignity that sunk, but he talks about how that dignity is, how it's still around. And what it really does is it makes you understand that God created us for something very special, and that people still retain a lot of what God created us for in them, and not all people are very special. And I think he just makes good arguments for us not to go too haywire with the evilness that we are, which I believe that we are. I believe that we're all fallen and that we all have a nature that is corrupt, but this just kind of balances the scales a little bit. Designed for Dignity. I would put this on the list, but I don't know if anybody would, you know, be able to make it through that whole thing, Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. Because we all are, also going to talk about, in one lecture, what it means to be, theologically speaking, what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, and how they fit into anthropology or biblical anthropology. So, Brum's going to cover all that. Okay, so let's dive in. Your notes, page 1. Let's start with the course outline. On the anthropology side, or the humanity side of it, we're going to talk about the why of man first, and then the what of man, then the fall of man, than the sex of humanity. Anthropology. You've heard that term. It's used in many different settings, including academic settings, including university settings. You can take classes on anthropology. What are classes on anthropology in the university? What would you expect to find there? Yeah, mainly it's just about the evolution of man. The what of man, how man became what he is. This, when we talk about biblical anthropology, it's much different, because we not only talk about the what of man, Well, I mean, a theist has big assumptions about the what of man, first of all. Once you establish that he's created by God, then you can move on to other issues. Instead of, you know, like in an anthropology class at the university, which is, the main bulk of it is trying to figure out what is man or where did man come from. So we're going to do things a lot differently. What you would expect to find in an anthropology class, such as free will. Free will is not necessarily covered in an anthropology class normally. It's usually covered in a, what kind of class? A what? You know, we're a philosophy class. Philosophy covers free will and the volition of man in that sense. So, but it'll be much different because it is a biblical anthropology. American Heritage Dictionary states it's the scientific study of the origin, the behavior, the physical, social, and cultural development of humans. Definition, we would state basically for our purposes here, it's the study of the purpose and nature of humanity, both in its pre-fall and post-fall state. That'll be the definition that's on your quiz. Very important to understand the distinction between pre-fall and post-fall. It'll have implications upon the post-resurrection state of man as well. So, although we're not going to get into that so much in this class, it will be something that's covered in eschatology. But it is something that we have to deal with to a certain degree about what will man be later, because what he will be later has implications upon what we are now. And a lot of time we have a huge folk theology about this esoteric nature that we're going to exist in once we get to heaven and exist in heaven forever, as if it's going to be so much different than we are now. The biggest difference is what?
Sin.
Once sin's eradicated out of our lives, we become full, much more have our full potential. But it's not as if we're going to be a whole lot different. I mean, you talk about flying and walking through walls and all kinds of things that we go off stating we're going to do because Christ walked through the walls, we're going to walk through. I just don't think so. I think very much of what we are now is going to be like what we are then. And to me, whenever I think that way, it gives me a lot more excitement about it because I have nothing to think about whenever you get so esoteric about the afterlife, which the Bible doesn't at all. We'll talk a whole lot about that especially once we get into eschatology. But, the things that we'll be doing then and the things that we're doing now be very similar, very similar. Working, responsibilities, successes and failures. Failures aren't sins. Failures are things in which you measure things by to be able to improve upon. It's not as if there's some, you know, we have such an idea that it's going to be some state of equilibrium in all things, relationships. We're going to love everybody the exact same. So therefore, you try to have some type of parallel in your mind to that, and you're just like, is there no movement? Is there no change? Is there no growth, development? But the Bible doesn't present it as such. The Bible presents what we are now and what we are before what we became now in Adam. What we will be then is a restoration of what we were supposed to be. And so, whenever the Bible presents it, it's not something that is so esoteric that we don't have any relation to. Paul compares it to a seed in a plant. And the seed is like the plant very much, or a seed in a tree.
The context here is with the comments of heaven in being that ultimately we don't spend eternity in heaven, we spend eternity with a new resurrected body in the new heaven and new earth. And that is our ultimate responsibility. Heaven is. We'll talk more about this in eschatology, but ultimately you have to understand that it's the new heaven and the new earth. That's what you were referring to, rather than just simply heaven as we understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
And that'll fill itself in more as we establish who we are now and what we're meant to be. And the problem that we have is our best example of a resurrected body is Christ. And we don't know that necessarily that is supposed to be the typical example of what we are. Christ always seems to be somewhat unique, and you, of course, understand why. So we'll deal with some of those things. Understanding what we are now will help us better understand and better prepare us to study for what we will become. And even if it's just merely a perfected version of ourselves, that would already be much more glorious than the earth we live in now.
Why study the doctrine of humanity? Because it significantly affects every other doctrine in theology. How you view humanity will determine whether or not you you believe that that people are capable of saving themselves, or capable of aiding in the salvation of themselves, or capable of contributing even the slightest bit, maybe faith, to the salvation of themselves, or if people are incapable of contributing anything to their salvation. And then that will affect your view of the sovereignty of God in this, and it just has domino effects everywhere. Just think of it as all these rows of dominoes going out, and it starts at this humanity. Wherever you decide on that, it affects everything. And it affects everything drastically. Among other things, it determines your views on sociology, politics, and family. All of these things will be affected. And when we talk about the role of man and woman, I mean, that's a huge issue in the last century about the rise of feminism and that sort of stuff. It comes from anthropology, a certain understanding about man. Politics, the same thing. How you vote politically will be based largely upon some issues, moral issues sometimes, it has to do about man, about whether this guy is going to today we have the issue of marrying homosexuals. That is an anthropological issue. We have the issue of abortion. That's an anthropological issue. All of these things will be affected. It will affect your views of psychology, and what I mean by that is whenever you start talking about psychology, two huge groups of people that, I'm not saying everybody falls in one extreme or the other, but there's two extremes whenever you come to psychology is that you don't, one extreme would state you don't have anything to do with psychology because psychology has nothing to do with anything but the soul or the spirit. And so whenever you deal with the soul and the spirit, where do you go to deal with it? Huh? Who can deal with the soul and the spirit? God, yeah. God is the only place to go, and so whenever people have some type of difficulty, mental difficulty, you're dealing with the soul, and so therefore the only place you should go is to God, and don't involve anybody else because they can't deal with that. Then another side would state, well, God has nothing to do with it, you just got to have the right combination of medicines to be able to correct the chemical imbalance that you're experiencing, because everything is ultimately chemical. All your thoughts, all your feelings, all your everything is ultimately chemical. So you've got two extremes in this, and it's anthropological issues that they're dealing with. I'm not saying that everybody falls in those extremes, but we'll talk about it more. But it will affect your views of psychology very much. And really, more than anything, it's where you view yourself on the human constitution. That will affect that. Humanity is something that everybody has expressed views about. It's not something that is esoteric to anybody. Everybody has views about these things. Christians, non-Christians, they have views about these things. They have an anthropology. And it will affect how you minister to both believers and non-believers. I mean, take this for example. If you believe that all people have in the fall have totally and completely lost the image of God, and only restored whenever God sovereignly comes in and restores it, then you will treat all people differently. You will state, well, this person has no dignity, as myself doesn't. I don't have any dignity outside of Christ. We are all, as one hymn put it, we are all worms. And if we're all worms, you will treat people as worms many times. And so that view will make you think one way about humanity. Another view is that all people are good at heart. All people ultimately want to do good. Deep down inside, they're not evil. It's just their influences. It's just their circumstances that have made them evil. And so whenever you treat this person, you're going to treat them differently than this person would treat the other person, right? So non-believers, you would treat differently if you have a degree of if you have an understanding of the dignity of God within them. And then finally, it'll affect how you view yourself. If you see yourself as nothing but a worm, then you're going to really treat yourself as nothing but a worm. Gregory Boyd says this: how you answer the question concerning the significance of being human will determine your views about what inherent rights people have, how people should be governed, and what authority, if any, they have to treat animals differently than they treat people. Indeed, how you answer these questions will greatly affect your views on whether it is legal to allow severely deformed babies to die, whether people have the right or responsibility to take others off life support, whether and when people have the right to choose abortion, and whether human cloning should be pursued. So, a lot of implications on our views today, issues today. So we start here with the question, why did God create man? Let me ask you that first. Why did God create man? Okay, he wanted a relationship for some reason. Okay. Why else?
Worship.
Worship, for them to worship him? So he just kind of egotistically wanted people to bow down to him, and so he created a bunch of people to bow down?
I don't know about egotistically.
It sounds that way, doesn't it? I mean, I'm God, and I want some people to worship me, so I'm going to create some people to worship me. I mean, it's hard, and this is we're getting to a point where, I mean, if I'll look through some of these systematic theologies and look for their anthropology section, and, you know, I expect that to be the very first question. You know, I expect that to be covered at the very beginning, but nobody covers it. It's like the very first thing is always, what is God? What is the image of God in man? Every single time, and it's not dealing with that issue. And so I'll get another textbook and look at it and say, come on, just somebody ask the question, why did God create man? I want to know why he created him. I remember I started struggling with this when I first started making this course and looking at all the notes, and the first thing I thought was, well, you need to ask why first. And so I'll ask that question and think it through, and as I was thinking it through, I was like, man, why did he create us? So I went into Christy, my wife, I said, Christy, why did God create us? She said, immediately, I mean, without even hesitating. I don't know. I've always asked that myself. And so that's a question I've always struggled with. And so I kept on looking through all the books. And actually, Grudem was the only one who covered it. And that was his first question. Why did God create man? Grudem seems to always cover the questions very... He just thinks, I think, a lot like normal people do. And ask those questions. But Grudem asked that question too. Why did God create man? And we'll look at some of these possible answers. The Westminster Catechism states this. What is the chief and highest end of man? So kind of states, what is the purpose of man? Or why did God create man? Man's chief and highest end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. So a kind of reciprocal, right? Glorify him and enjoy him. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, most of the time we'd say all of creation, it seems to be made for man in the purpose that he has for man. Because at the very end, the kind of the crowning achievement in creation seems to be man, doesn't it? There's a more specific question that states, why was I created? And I do better with that question than I do with why was man created. I can kind of place myself within certain relationships and certain purposes and state, well, because God wanted me to do this. But at the very beginning, we almost ask the question, a lot of people do ask this question, what was the lack within God that he had to create man? Or what was the reason that he had to create man? Or was there a need that made him have to create man? I mean, ultimately, you would state, you know, if the Bible doesn't have an answer, it's left a mystery and we shouldn't go any further. But we'll try to struggle with this a little bit and see what the Bible has to say about the why of man. And hopefully we'll be able to come to a few conclusions. The Declaration of Independence says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed with their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, that's not answering the question, why did God create man? But what do you think the assumption is that God created man for in this paragraph? Right. To establish America, of course. Sorry.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Well, I mean, he created them with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's almost as if we're stating God created us to pursue happiness, to pursue life, to pursue liberty. Right? Because these are rights of ours that were given from the very beginning. So among whatever it is, the purposes of God, one of those is to create us for a purpose of having life, liberty, and happiness. And that answers implicitly the question of why God created man, at least according to the Constitution, right? And then Rick Warren says in his new devotional that it's kind of all the rage. The very first statement in that is, it's not about you. Kind of like that. Whatever it is, it's not about you, right? But I'm not necessarily saying I agree with that totally. I think that if we go that direction, then we lose a lot of the Westminster catechisms to enjoy him forever. God enjoys giving enjoyment. And so to some degree, the nice thing is what I'll make the argument is, to some degree, it is also about us. It's about God giving, and his giving is great, and his giving is something great for us. And so the enjoyment that we receive from it, I think if God were to want us just to have this beginning point of all of anthropology that it has nothing to do with us, I just don't think that's true and biblical. I think it's pious. Right, I think it's a good statement in certain contexts, but I think that it is some about us, because God has created us in his image for a purpose, and that purpose is not for us just to be pawns to whatever purpose he has without anything that we receive. Why did God create man? Wrong answers. We'll just start with those. God did not create man. Naturalism. Man is an eternal extension of who and what God is. Pantheism and panentheism. If you remember, pantheism and panentheism, God is a part of creation, a part of us, so therefore we are God, or extension of what God is. And so God did not create man because there was never a time whenever we did not exist in some form or another, because we are part of God. Man is eternal as God is eternal. That is also pantheism and polytheism. We never were created. God needed help with his new creation. You know, God decided to create things, and you know, he needed a little bit of help upkeeping the garden. Or God was in need of a companion. Now, what's the problem with that? Does God need anything? Do we have a scriptural basis for that? I ask you that. I can't even pull it up in my mind.
That God is in need of man.
No, that God isn't in need of anything. Whenever he's rhetorically asking the questions, if I was in need, would I ask you? You know, remember that passage? Don't know where it's at, but I bet it's there.
Isaiah 55.
So maybe in the latter part of Job, whenever he's... also, in one of the passages, he says, "I own the cattle on a thousand hills. I'm in need of nothing." It's what, do you know the theological term? Although we didn't cover that in Trinitarianism, so I don't want you to think you should remember. But you know the theological term that means that God is in need of nothing. It starts with an A, aseity. He is in need of nothing, and so we have a doctrine that is built scripturally that God doesn't need anything. It's not as if God was eternally in need, and so therefore he finally was able to create something that fulfilled this need.
Is he exercising merely what he in fact is? And part of God is in fact a creative aspect which allows him to create, and does that then give us definition as to man being creative and something that we are also supposed to fulfill?
That's right.
And furthermore, we can't know the mind of the Lord. And so there is a limit. And it certainly is good to ask some of these questions, and I think God allows us to do that. But we don't want to draw necessarily absolute conclusive arguments. I think what you said is good, that ultimately he saw that it was good. I think ultimately we see that he is creative. And those help to fill that in.
Doesn't it help us very much define our meta-purpose, doesn't it? When we talk about our smaller purposes, my purpose within my family, my purpose within this church, my purpose in the broader perspective in my community, you know, you can fill in the blanks there. But there's got to be a meta purpose that we answer. There's got to be a statement that says, why is all this here? Otherwise, we're just diving down into something without looking at the big picture first. And we always try to look at the big picture and then zoom in. And sometimes that big picture is left obscure, but it's okay as long as we tackle it for a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, in John Piper's book, Let the Nations Be Glad, which is really a missions book, he deals with the issue that a lot of people bring up, or a few people would bring up that have really struggled with this question more. And the issue is, if God created everybody just to glorify Him, He defends against the idea that God is an egotistical, God who's just looking to build Himself up, and it can seem that way, can't it? It can seem that way when we give the answer and state, well, He created us to glorify Him, and that's it, period, and that's what we're to do. And then you're thinking of God in eternity before creation, sitting there going, wish there were people around here glorifying me, And, I think I'll create some people to do that. And it does create that impression in your mind to a certain degree.
I want to go back to number 5, though. Why was God was in need of a companion? What do we do with that? Was He? Why not? Why wasn't God in need of a companion? He was triune. He wasn't alone. Okay? There's companionship within the very nature of the Trinity. 3 in 1, part of the majesty of the Godhead. Furthermore, why else, if He was in need of a companion, how come He didn't get one? Are we God's companions? Is that how we're presented? Are we to be companions with God? Biblically? I know we might throw those terms around in evangelicalism. God is my friend, God's the big guy upstairs. But is that how the Bible presents it? Companionship with God? Let's go back to Adam here just for a moment. Do we have time to go to Adam?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got Adam time.
We got Adam time.
All right. Okay, so Genesis 1, I'll get my Bible to pretend I'm looking at it. Genesis 1, we have creation. Genesis 2, we have then the detail of man's creation. So God creates man. Right now, that's as far as we are. And He creates man, and what does He say about man and creation? All we have now is the world, obviously, is fully created, all the animals and everything. He's created Adam. So Adam is the only person on earth. And what does God say?
It's not good for him to be alone.
He was alone, and that was not good. Now, here's the big problem. Was Adam alone? No. He had a relationship with God. He had a personal relationship with God. Often what we teach in evangelicalism, would you like to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? Sort of like that's even possible. We have one example of a personal relationship with God. We have Adam and God. They walked in the garden. And what did God say about that type of relationship? Not good. It's not good. That's right. It's not good because to relate to God, God is so much more infinite. Even though Adam was sinless, God is so much more than what man is, that it is helpful for man to have a companion who he can relate with, which will help him relate to his Creator. The need for community comes up. That is where the theology of community begins, and that is ultimately the role of the church. We need each other to communicate with God. Because how I treat Michael and how Michael treats me helps to reflect how we treat or how we love each other, how we love our Father who is in heaven, right? How does John identify Christians? They will know that we are Christians by what means?
Love.
Love for the Father? Is that the implication from the text? No. Brother one to another. You see, and it starts right from Adam. From Adam, right from the very beginning, it was an incomplete idea for simply man to be directly connected with God. Man had to be connected with other people, with mankind, if you will. And that's very important to see that this is often something we become shaky on. God was in need of companionship. We forget the Trinitarian doctrine, which is that there is community within the Godhead between Father, Son, and Spirit. And furthermore, that we are not on a companion level with God. Whatever level it is, companionship isn't the right word to describe it. And you'll see, we're going to flesh this out more.
One thing also that was brought up here is we talk about the creation narrative, and somebody else brought up that God is a creative God. When we distinguish between the two, being creative and being in need, whatever that need may be. When we say God was in need of a companion, we might state God was in need of a blank, you know, and fill it in. And whatever you fill in will be wrong, because you've got things going towards God. Whatever you state that God in eternity decided, it was not something that he stated, I need, fill in the blank, whatever it is. There was nothing he was in need of. But the opposite is where we've got to build and start of the why of man, is like he stated, he is a creative God. And so it's not going towards God as a need, it's going out from God as an attribute, who God is. Now, what other things can we state about who God is? What is the one of the things that we hold most dearly about who God is? He is what?
Love.
And he is gracious, and he is kind, and he is, you know, on and on we go. And all of those things are outward acts. Whenever he stated about Adam, it was not good that he is alone, he didn't state, well, he's not good enough right now to give me what I need. He's not good enough right now to worship me. He said, it's not good that he's alone, so I'm going to make a helpmeet suitable for him. What is God's purpose there? Who's he thinking of? He's thinking of man. He's not thinking of myself. Well, this guy's not quite ready to worship me the way I need to be worshipped. Worship is always a natural response to something that is already true. It's not something that is demanded. It cannot be demanded. It is something that is given because of a realization of someone. When we serve God, we don't serve God out of our obligation to serve him. Anytime we begin to serve him out of our obligation, it's not true service. We serve him because what? Yeah, because we love him, because we are grateful. We love him because he first loved us. We do what we do to him because he is given to us. And so God's purpose in this seems to start from the self-giving God. He is wanting to give. He is wanting to create and to give to people. And so it's such a great thing to be able to start there rather than a need. I mean, that God is in need of something, because we're always insufficient to fulfill any need. And we're grossly lacking in those things. But God has created because he's not only creative, he is self-giving. He is eternally self-giving. And this is part of his self-giving nature. And I think it was probably the same with the angels. But whatever conclusions we come to, whatever reason he created us, it's out of his attributes. It's an extension of who he is. Not part of what he is, but the reason given for doing it is an extension of what he is. And I think that puts a little bit more balance to our understanding of stating, I like the Westminster Catechism. I like many of the things they say. Those people thought through things very well. But to glorify God, the chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. I like the aspect of fulfillment in who, what we are. And something going to us. Because you and I are the ones who are in need. And God is the one who can fulfill it. And he is the one who is the giving God. God isn't in need.
And furthermore, that is what the New Testament is teaching. And you look at what Ephesians 5 is talking about. And this will come back later. I think it will. With husbands loving your wives and wives loving your husbands. Issues like that. Loving your brother. Showing love to each other. The commandments boil down to love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. God is loved in our love for each other. God is loved because we are all part of his creation in how we treat others. And sometimes when we think about God, we always think this vertical relationship, when he's looking just as much as at our horizontal relationships. And you'll see that this class and this discussion on anthropology will help us to begin to understand even expressing love to the Father isn't necessarily a vertical thing, but it's a horizontal thing which he looks down and blesses. Or he looks down and is blessed by.
Good.
Go ahead.
Good. Here's some relevant scriptures that I thought help us in answering this. In Psalm it says, when I consider the work of the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you take thought of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than God. You crown him with glory and majesty. You make him to rule over the works of your hands, and you have put all things under his feet. The idea is, look at me in comparison to you, God, and yet you are self-giving. You are giving all the time. You have placed us in these positions. You have made us a little lower than God. And the idea is stating that our dignity or our image, we are created in the image of God, and you have created us like you. Why would you do something like that? But the implication is God is just giving. and it's confusing to the psalmist why he is so giving. Job 7, 17 and 18 says, "What is man that you magnify him and that you are concerned about him, that you examine him every morning and try him every moment?" 1 Corinthians 10:31 states, "Then whether then you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God."
What is it that we can do for glorifying God? What does the verse say? Eat, drink, kind of normal everyday things. It's in the mundane that God is brought honor and glory. How are we to remember Christ's death? What are we doing in remembrance of Christ? Eating and drinking. And what are we eating and drinking? What does Christ recommend?
Bread
and wine, just the regular stuff. Not some special cake or something, regular bread. And in those days, wine was the drink. It was the only way to keep water clean, was to ferment it. And so that was the regular things. It's in the mundane. It's in the regular everyday. It's in how you treat your people at work or at home, your relationships, your day-to-day events. That is what brings glory to God. Look at the verse. Whether then you eat or drink. Guess what? We all did both of those things today, right? Whatever you do, eat or drink, or whatever you do, okay? You're at home, you're at school, you're at work, you're involved in these things, you have these events, you're planning these ideas, you have these relationships going on. In all those things, the regular stuff, if you will, do all for the glory of God. So it's not go to a mountain and remove yourself from society and live there for 3 years and be totally silent, and that will bring honor to God. It's in what you do. In the life that you live, you are to bring honor and glory to God. Very important to understand that God expects us to live life. He likes that we drive cars. He likes that we go to work and go to school. He likes the regular things. All of those things can be taken to an extreme. But in the regular things, are you driving your car for the glory of God? Those types of questions.
Next verse is like it. It says, "Whoever speaks, let it be with God's word. Whoever serves, do so with the strength that God supplies, so that in everything God will be glorified through Jesus Christ. To him belong the glory and power forever and ever." In Ephesians 1, it says God has predestined, having been predestined, speaking about people or believers, having been predestined according to his purpose, who works all things after the counsel of his will. And none of these speak directly to the issue that we have stated, why did God create man, but it helps us as we try to construct our theology of the why of man. Romans 8:30 says, "Those whom he predestined, he also called; those who he also justified, and those who he justified, he also what? Glorified." So again, we have another element, at least by looking at the end, at least by looking at the purpose or the goal of man. We can see bits and elements of the why of man. And so we see a lot of things being introduced here, and Daniel has another one that's like the previous one. "Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven." What does that mean? I mean, we're not all become the stars and have to wear sunglasses all the time because we're shining so bright. Isn't this a good thing that it's stating? I mean, this is our reward. It's going to be to shine brightly forever and ever. And the idea, we have the common idiom even today, that man really shined today. He shined brightly. It means display, your glory or your attributes forever and ever. And God does state that we will be glorified. God does state that he is going to share in his glory with us. God does state that we, like here, will shine like stars forever and ever. And it's a reward that he is stating for us, for the people who have been redeemed. And so I think he wants to do that, right? It's something that is part of his plan. Whenever he states that he is going to glorify us, whenever he says, "And those he justified, he also glorified."
And those in the world ask, why would God allow this? Where is God when this happens? How come God allows a famine or an earthquake or something like that to happen? Who is it always an indictment against when they ask that question?
God.
Ultimately Christ. Who else? us, the church, those who represent Christ on earth. When they ask, where is God, we are the ones who are supposed to be putting up our hands and say, he's working right here through me and through this person and that person and that person. And it always is a mark on the church as to why aren't you active? Why aren't you actively representing God when that is what he's called you to do? Interesting idea, as some of the hard questions that we struggle with philosophically, where is God when such and such? The answer should be, well, God is living through the work of the Spirit, which is manifested in the body of the believers, which is the church. That's us. And it is a call for us to become more active.
Let's get out our Bibles and read a few passages here about creation. We'll start with Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was without shape and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the watery deep. But the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the water. Now, it just jumps into a narrative, doesn't it? Immediately jumps into a narrative. From the very beginning, it doesn't say, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth so that man would have a place to dwell, so that man would be able to do such and such. Or it doesn't say, in the beginning God was lonely and he wanted a companion. That's what I asked my daughter, my 4-year-old daughter. I said, why did God create us? She said, because he was lonely. But it doesn't tell us anything, so we can't really go there. It doesn't help us out. Move over to verse 26. And we'll look at 26 through 31. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the cattle and over the earth, and over all the creatures that move on the earth. So there is a so that, right? Let us make man so that. And it talks about so that he would have dominion over the earth. God created man after his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and every creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I now give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the entire earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the animals of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And then there was an evening and morning and a sixth day. Now in that, you look at it, and if you were to draw a purpose statement purely from that, you would state, well, God did create everything, and I guess he needed somebody to tend it, right? It's kind of hard to tell. So if we were just to look there, that's all the information that we would get. And we'd be left a little bit obscure as to the why of creation. Well, why did he create the earth, as you stated? And it's very, very important for us to be able to see that in our theology of creation. That is, it is based, and I hope we're getting there. It is based upon a giving God, a God who it's his eternal nature to give, a God who will not only gave now, gave at creation, gives in his Son. He will be giving in his glory. He gives in eternity. He gave before we ever existed. He is a giving God. It's part of his eternal attributes. And remember what we talked about, the attributes of God. They're not something that come and go. They're part of who he is eternally. And so why shouldn't we see that displayed here? Look at chapter 2, verse 7. It says, the Lord God formed man from the soil of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. And the Lord planted an orchard or a garden in the east in Eden, and there he placed the man he had formed. And the Lord made all kinds of trees grow from the soil, every tree that was pleasing to look at and good for food. Pleasing to look at for who? Man, not for God. I don't think he needed food either. He's doing all of this, pleasing to look at for man. He is creating this. He's creating the food for man. Now the tree of life was in the center, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They were in the middle of the orchard. Now at that point, if we stopped and said, "Well, I of man," we would still be left you know, a little bit, I'm not quite sure. I haven't really got my arms around it. It seems to be that he's a very giving God, and he is giving to man a lot. And then we have this these trees that are planted. Now turn to verse 15. We're going to read 15 to 25. The Lord God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to care for it and maintain it. And the Lord commanded the man, "You may freely eat the fruit from every tree in the orchard." Now let's just stop right there. I mean, you've got a creation, you've got man, you've got him placed in this garden, all of these things being created for him, around him, to look at, to eat. And now he's giving to him and saying, "Now I give you all these things of the orchard." If we were to stop there, we would say, man, that God just gave to give. He created to give. You know, it's like he was overflowing wanting to give. And maybe you have children in which you're able to relate to that, to state you just love to give to them. I mean, that's one of your greatest enjoyments, is just to give and to make them happy. I think God is doing that. I think his purpose is to give, and I think it will be for all eternity. I mean, the God isn't moving to plan B after the fall. I think that the restoration of all the things that fell, we're going to see the giving of God to even a greater degree. But the greatest degree we see it in is the giving of the Son, like I said.
Now remember, there's no sin yet. We've had no issues of that. And already man has an assignment. Okay? Put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it. Now we have no weeds. We have no thistles and things like that. Those haven't come along yet. The ground isn't hard at this point and dry. But man still has something that he is supposed to do. He's supposed to cultivate the garden. And so it is out of passages like this that we will begin to also see what will the future resurrection be like. Michael said, it may be very similar where we have jobs and assignments. Here man is told to cultivate the garden. It has nothing to do with sin. Nothing wrong with cultivating the garden. But certainly cultivating a garden where the land isn't dry and there's no weeds and no thistles, certainly that would be more enjoyable, though work, than working where you have to fight disease and pests and thistles and thorns and drought and all those types of things. So notice that there's an assignment for man.
And not only notice that, but that's part of the giving nature of God, is whenever he gives assignments. I mean, if you could think of heaven, okay, as sometimes we do, or the new heaven and the new earth, but we'll stick with our folk theology and think of heaven to where we're sitting on a cloud playing a harp all the time, you know, that is very unattractive to me. Not only is that unattractive to me, but whenever we sometimes state all we're going to be doing 24/7 is sitting before the throne of God, bowing down and worshiping him. I'm sorry, that's not what we're going to be doing, and that's very unattractive. And if you're pious, you might state, well, I'll be able to do it whenever I'm there because I'll have a whole different mindset. Well, you'll be a different person, you know. If you have a different mindset and you're trying to convince yourself that you'll enjoy doing that 24/7, you've got a whole different view on the purpose of God, the purpose of man, and the restoration of man in that. Certainly, we're going to be bowing in adoration to God all the time, worshiping him, but does that mean we have to be sitting in front of his throne doing it 24 hours a day? No. God does it through our work, through the things that we do, we worship him. And the same thing with Adam here. Adam is given a job, but this job as he's given it is part of the fulfillment of God, just as the food is the part of the fulfillment that God is giving him. Man is created with a need to be able to have significance, to excel at something, to be able to make a difference at things. And Adam was given an assignment to make a difference in this garden. And so it's part of the nature of us to be able to excel, but it's the self-giving in nature of God who gives us things to excel at. And so this is in no way stating, but here's one thing, you know, if you're going to live in the garden, you've got to keep it. I'm sorry, you know, I would have angels come down and keep it for you so you could, you know, sit on a rock all day long and not do anything. But it's part of the giving nature. The fall member is what makes jobs struggle, or makes us struggle at them. But it's not what makes jobs. But look at the comparison of the two. We do get to the point where he says, you may freely eat, and then in 17, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you shall surely die. Compare the two, okay? All the self-giving of God, but the restriction that he placed on the one thing, you know? And certainly it was to test man. I don't think there was anything inherently evil. This is an eternal tree that God just has always hated, and anybody who associates with this tree is going to be, you know, cast to hell. But it's just really a commandment that is given, which he could have stated, anybody who eats from this grass right here, you know. It's just not abiding by that commandment.
Why the tree? The tree is there to give us the choice, and this is where the debate on free will becomes, stems from, is that God gave us the freedom to choose. Adam made a choice, and interestingly enough, in Adam, we've all made a choice, and we've said, no, God, we're not that interested in you. Yeah, you've given us quite a bit, but we can take it from here. I mean, that's Adam's. Look at what Adam, we're not actually going to get to this sin. It's a very interesting sin that Adam commits, because what can he gain from eating from the tree? Well, even that is a deception, what he can actually gain. But the tree is there to give us the freedom, and it's a great question. It's a great question, because so many times we wish, oh, if only there wasn't the tree. But if there isn't the tree, there isn't the temptation. If there isn't the temptation, there isn't the option. If there isn't the option, then we are simply robots. We are simply actors living out a script. We're called to worship, and we worship. We make no conscious decision. And the Imago Dei, the image of God, the idea of choosing, is something God put in man, which reflects who God is, which allows man to then choose God again. And man made the wrong choice.
Is the Bible obscure or clear as to the motivation behind creation of man? And we would state that it is somewhat clear, but somewhat obscure, if that makes any sense. We don't have any statements that state this is why God created man, but we can come to some conclusions. We know that God is a creative God. We also know that he created so that he would receive glory from his creation. And I probably would change that from the so that, because we know that that is an outcome of it, but not necessarily so much a purpose of it. So that God would be able to share his glory with others. I think that's one of the biggest things we receive from the Bible, especially in the creation narrative. Give, 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 give. He's a giving God. And we see that all throughout, from the very beginning to the giving of His Son to the giving of His glory in the end. And then finally, we would state, as it states in Ephesians, to accomplish His will, whatever end that might hold. I mean, that's kind of a cop-out, but it is true that God has His purposes and He accomplishes His purposes. But I think we need to see this in the framework, and it's got to start our anthropology, is that God created us because He's a giving God, and that whatever that means, that is we are not fully partaking in that which He has given us now, especially in our fallen state. But God is restoring that, and ultimately it will be all restored. Thank you.
Scene 1, Apple, take 1.